A small porthole above was the only source of light and air. The porthole served another purpose as well. The warders enjoyed urinating on us from above. It was still light when we were led on deck, and we saw the island for the first time. Green and beautiful, it looked at first more like a resort than a prison. Esikitini, at the island. That is how the Xhosa people describe the narrow, wind-swept outcrop of rock that lies 8 miles off the coast of Cape Town. Everyone knows which island you are referring to. I first heard about the island as a child. Robben Island was well known among the Xhosas after Makona, also known as Nkele, the 6-foot-6-inch commander of the Xhosa army in the Fourth Xhosa War, was banished there by the British after leading 10,000 warriors against Grahamstown in 1819. He tried to escape from Robben Island by boat, but drowned before reaching shore. The memory of that loss is woven into the language of my people, who speak of a forlorn hope. Makana was not the first African hero confined on the island. In 1658, Otshumau, known to European historians as Harry the Strandloper, was banished by Jan van Riebeck during a war between the Khoikhoi and the Dutch. I took solace in the memory of Otshumau, for he is reputed to be the first and only man to ever escape from Robben Island, and he did so by rowing to the mainland in a small boat. The island takes its name from the Dutch word for seal, hundreds of which once cavorted in the icy Benguela currents that washed the shores. Later, the island was turned into a leper colony, a lunatic asylum, and a naval base. The government had only recently turned the island back into a prison. We were met by a group of burly white warders shouting, "This is the island. Here you will die." Ahead of us was a compound flanked by a number of guardhouses. Armed guards lined the path to the compound. It was extremely tense. A tall, red-faced warder yelled at us, "Here I am your boss." He was one of the notorious Kleinhans brothers, known for their brutality to prisoners. The warders always spoke in Afrikaans. If you replied in English, they would say, "I don't understand that Kaffir lover's language." As we walked toward the prison, the guards shouted, "Two-two, two-two," meaning we should walk in pairs, two in front, two behind. I linked up with Tefu. The guards started screaming, "Hass! Hass!" The word "hass" means "move" in Afrikaans, but it is customarily reserved for cattle. The warders were demanding that we jog, and I turned to Tefu and under my breath said that we must set an example. If we gave in now, we would be at their mercy. Tefu nodded his head in agreement. We had to show them that we were not everyday criminals, but political prisoners being punished for our beliefs. I motioned to Tefu that we too should walk in front, and we took the lead. Once in front, we actually decreased the pace, walking slowly and deliberately. The guards were incredulous. "Listen," Kleinhans said, "this is not Johannesburg. This is not Pretoria. This is Robben Island, and we will tolerate no insubordination here. Hass! Hass!" But we continued at our stately pace. Kleinhans ordered us to halt and stood in front of us. "Look, man, we will kill you. We are not fooling around. Your wives and children and mothers and fathers will never know what happened to you. This is the last warning. Hass! Hass!" To this I said, "You have your duty and we have ours." I was determined that we would not give in, and we did not, for we were already at the cells. We were ushered into a rectangular stone building and taken to a large open room. The floor was covered with water a few inches deep. The guards yelled, "Undress! Undress!" As we removed each item of clothing, the guards would grab it, search it quickly, and then throw it in the water. Jacket off, searched, thrown in the water. Then the guards commanded us to get dressed, by which they meant for us to put on our soaking clothes. Two officers entered the room. The less senior of the two was a captain whose name was Yerrick. From the start, we could see that he was intent on manhandling us. The captain pointed to Aaron Maletti, the youngest of the four of us, and a very mild and gentle person, and said, "Why is your hair so long?" Aaron said nothing. The captain shouted, "I'm talking to you. Why is your hair so long? It is against regulations. Your hair should have been cut. Why is it long?" And then he paused and turned to look at me and said, "Like this, boys," pointing at me. I began to speak. "Now look here. The length of our hair is determined by the regulations." Before I could finish, he shouted in disbelief, "Never talk to me that way, boy," and began to advance. I was frightened. It is not a pleasant sensation to know that someone is about to hit you and you are unable to defend yourself. When he was just a few feet from me, I said as firmly as I could, "If you so much as lay a hand on me, I will take you to the highest court in the land, and when I finish with you, you will be as poor as a church mouse." The moment I began speaking, he paused, and by the end of my speech he was staring at me with astonishment. I was a bit surprised myself. I had been afraid, and spoke not from courage, but out of a kind of bravado. At such times, one must put up a bold front despite what one feels inside. "Where's your ticket?" he asked, and I handed it to him. I could see he was nervous. "What's your name?" he said. I nodded my head toward the ticket and said, "It is written there." He said, "How long are you in for?" I said again, gesturing toward the ticket, "It is written there." He looked down and said, "5 years. You are in for 5 years, and you are so arrogant. Do you know what it means to serve 5 years?" I said, "That is my business. I am ready to serve 5 years, but I am not prepared to be bullied. You must act within the law." No one had informed him who we were, or that we were political prisoners, or that I was a lawyer. I had not noticed it myself, but the other officer, a tall, quiet man, had vanished during our confrontation. I later discovered that he was Colonel Stein, the commanding officer of Robben Island. The captain then left, much quieter than he had entered. We were then by ourselves, and Steve, his nerves jangling, could not stop speaking. "We have provoked the Boer," he said. "Now we are in for a rough time." He was in the midst of speaking when a stocky fellow named Lieutenant Pretorius walked in. To our surprise, Pretorius spoke to us in Xhosa, which he seemed to know quite well. "We have looked at your records, and they are not so bad, all except this one," he said, nodding toward Steve. "Your record is filthy." Steve exploded. "Who are you to talk to me like that? You say I have a filthy record. You have read my files, eh? Well, you will find that all those convictions were for cases I was fighting for the rights of my people. I am not a criminal. You are the criminal." The lieutenant then warned Steve that he would charge him if he ever addressed him in that way again. Before leaving, the lieutenant said he was placing us in a single large cell with windows that faced outside, and then added, rather ominously, "But I don't want you to talk to anyone through those windows, especially you, Mandela." We were then taken to our cell, one of the best I had ever seen. The windows were large and within easy reach. From one set of windows we could see other prisoners and warders as they walked past. It was spacious, certainly large enough for the four of us, and had its own toilets and showers. It had been an exhausting day, and a short while later, after a supper of cold porridge, the others went to sleep. I was lying on my blanket on the floor when I heard a tapping at the window. I looked up and saw a white man beckoning me to come to the glass. I remembered the lieutenant's admonition and stayed put. Then I heard the fellow whisper, "Nelson, come here." The fact that he knew my name intrigued me, and I decided to take a chance. I went over to the window and looked at him. He must have realized that I thought he was white, because the first thing he whispered was, "I'm a colored warder from Bloemfontein." He then gave me news of my wife. There had been a report in the Johannesburg newspapers that my wife had come to see me at Pretoria Local, but that they had not informed her that I had been taken to Robben Island. I thanked him for the information. "Do you smoke?" he said. I told him that I did not, and he seemed disappointed. I then got the idea. "Yes, but my comrades do." He brightened at this and said he would return in a few minutes with tobacco and sandwiches. Everyone was now awake. Tefu and John Getsiwe smoked, and I split the pouch of tobacco between them, and we all divided the sandwiches. For the next few weeks, the colored warder came almost every night with tobacco and sandwiches, and each night I would divide up the tobacco evenly between Tefu and Getsiwe. The warder was taking great risks, and he warned me that he was only prepared to deal directly with me, or the arrangement was off. When we arrived on the island, we had no idea how many other prisoners were there. Within a few days, we learned there were about 1,000 men, all Africans, all recent arrivals. Most of these men were common law prisoners, but I knew there would be some political prisoners among them. I wanted to contact them, but we were completely isolated. For the first few days, we were kept locked in our cell and not even permitted outside. We demanded to be taken to work like the other prisoners, and this was soon granted. But we were taken out alone, supervised by Kleinhans. Our first job was covering up some newly laid pipe, and we were on a small hill and could see some of the island, which was wild and lovely. We worked hard that first day, but on succeeding days, Kleinhans pushed us harder. He did this crudely, as one would urge on a horse or cow. "No, man, come on, go on." At one point, Steve, who was older than the rest of us, put down his shovel and was immediately threatened by Kleinhans. But Steve, in Afrikaans, responded, "You ignoramus who cannot even speak your own language properly, you cannot tell me what to do. I will work at my own rate. That is what I am prepared to do, and that is all I can do." Then, with great dignity, he picked up his shovel and resumed work. Steve had been a teacher of Afrikaans, and he not only spoke perfect Afrikaans, but its antecedent, High Dutch. Steve would speak to the warders in a condescending and grandiloquent style that they probably did not understand. But they knew better than to engage him in a verbal battle. There were two Kleinhans brothers on the island, both reputed to have viciously assaulted prisoners. We were looked after by the older brother, who must have been warned to restrain himself, for he never touched us. The younger one was under no such constraints. One day, we were walking back from work along a road and passed a workspan of several hundred prisoners carting sand in wheelbarrows. They were non-political prisoners, and both of our groups were ordered to halt while the two brothers had a chat. The younger brother ordered one of his men to polish his boots while he talked. I recognized some of the men in the other workspan as those who had been sentenced to death in the Sekukuneland peasant revolt of 1958, and I turned around to get a better look at them. The younger brother rudely ordered me to look the other way. I do not know how I would have reacted had I not been standing in full view of the other prisoners, but my pride was now at stake. I refused to turn around. The younger Kleinhans advanced with the obvious intent of assaulting me. But when he was a few steps away, his brother ran over, grabbed him, whispered a few words, and the incident passed. One day, we were visited by the head of the prison, who was responsible for running all of Robben Island and had come to hear our complaints. Theron was a sour fellow who did not like to deal with prisoners face to face. I did not want to alienate him, but I was not going to cringe. "We are grateful that you have come to see us," I said, speaking for the group, "because we have a number of problems which I am certain you will be able to sort out." I enumerated the problems, and when I finished, he said, "I will see what I can do." Perhaps he thought he had given in too easily, because as he was walking out, he turned to Tefu, who had a large belly, and said, "That great stomach of yours is going to disappear here in prison." Steve did not take kindly to the prison head's jab, and he was incapable of letting an insult go unanswered. "You know, Captain," he said, "there is nothing you can do to me that can truly affect me, for I am a member of the most revolutionary political organization in the world, the Communist Party, which has a distinguished record of service to oppressed people around the globe. You and your poor National Party will be on the ash heap of history while we are ruling the world. I am better known internationally than your witless state president. Who are you? A small functionary not even worth paying attention to. By the time I leave prison, I won't even know your name." Theron turned on his heel and left. The nightly visits of our colored warder went a long way to mitigate the harshness of the island. But even with this luxury, Steve was still dissatisfied. Tefu was a heavy smoker. He would sometimes puff away the entire night, leaving himself no tobacco for the next day. Gayasewi, however, conserved his tobacco and never ran out. One evening, in a particularly irritable mood, Tefu confronted me. "Nelson," he said, "you are shortchanging me. You are giving Gayasewi more tobacco than me." This was not true, but I thought I would play a game with him. "Very well, then," I said. "Every night when I get the tobacco, I will first divide it into two portions, and then I will let you choose which one you want." That night, and each night afterward, I separated the tobacco into equal piles and said to Steve, "Choose." Tefu would be in an agony of indecision. He would look at both piles, his head swinging back and forth between the two. Finally, in frustration, he would grab one of the piles and go off and begin to smoke. Though this process seemed to me eminently fair and also humorous, Tefu was still unhappy. He began to hover about when the warder came to the window in order to make sure that I was not hoarding the tobacco. This made the warder uncomfortable. "Look," he said to me, "I only deal with you. It is a question of security." I said I understood and told Tefu that he could not be around when I was dealing with the warder. The next night, however, when the warder came to the window, Tefu strode up to the bars and said to him, "From now on, I want my own tobacco. Just give it to me directly." The warder panicked. "Mandela," he said, "you have broken our agreement. No more. I won't be bringing you these things." I shooed Tefu away and remonstrated with the warder. I said, "Look, man, this is an old chap," meaning Tefu, "and he's not very normal," I said, pointing to my head. "Make an exception." So he softened and gave me the supplies, but warned if it happened again, that would be the end. That night, I thought it necessary to punish Tefu. I said, "Now look, you have jeopardized our supplies. You are not going to have any tobacco or sandwiches tonight. You have almost lost us these privileges, so we're cutting you off until you improve." Tefu was silent. We stayed in one corner of the cell that night, eating our sandwiches and reading the paper the warder also brought for us. Tefu sat by himself in the opposite corner. Eventually, we drifted off to sleep. At about midnight, I felt an arm on my shoulder jostling me awake. "Nelson! Nelson!" It was Tefu. "Nelson," he said, speaking softly, "you have hit me in a weak spot. You have deprived me of my tobacco. I am an old man. I have suffered for my commitment to my people. You are the leader here in jail, and you are punishing me like this. It is not fair, Nelson." He had hit me in a weak spot. I felt as though I had abused my power. He had indeed suffered far more than I. I had not eaten half my sandwich, and I immediately gave it to him. I roused Getsiwe. I had given him all the tobacco, and asked him if he would share it with Tefu. Tefu was always difficult, but from that point on, he behaved much better. Once we started working, I got some sense of what life was like for other prisoners on the island. The authorities also moved some young political prisoners from the PAC into the cells opposite ours. At night, we were able to talk with them through the barred door. Among these young men, I discovered, was Nkwabeni Menye, a nephew of mine from Nkizweni, whom I had last seen when he was a baby in 1941.
We conversed about the Transkei and caught up on family history. One night, while his friends were gathered around him, he said, "Uncle, what organization do you belong to?" "The ANC," I said, "of course." My response caused consternation among those young men, and suddenly their faces disappeared from the window. After some time, my nephew reappeared and asked me whether or not I had ever been a member of the PAC. I replied that I had not. He then said he had understood that I joined the PAC during my Africa tour. I told him that I had not, that I had always been a member of the ANC and that I always would be. This again caused dismay among them, and they vanished.
I later learned that PAC propaganda claimed that I had joined the organization when I was traveling elsewhere on the continent. Although I was not pleased to hear this, it did not surprise me. In politics, one can never underestimate how little people know about a situation. A short while later, my nephew was back and asked me if I had met and talked with Sobukwe at Pretoria Local. I said that I had, and that we had very good discussions. This pleased them, and they said good night, and that was the last I saw of them. A few hours later that same evening, a captain came to our cell and commanded the four of us to pack our belongings. Within minutes, my comrades were taken away, leaving me in the cell by myself. In prison, one counts oneself lucky to be able to wave goodbye to one's comrades. One can be in extraordinarily intimate circumstances with someone for months and then never see the person again. It is dehumanizing, for it forces one to adapt by becoming more self-contained and insulated. Now that I was alone, I was also somewhat anxious. There is sometimes safety in numbers. When you are alone, there are no witnesses. I realized I had not been served any food and banged on the door. "Warden, I have not received my supper." "You must call me Boss," he yelled. I went hungry that night. Very early the next morning, I was taken back to Pretoria. The Department of Prisons released a statement to the press that I had been removed from the island for my own safety because PAC prisoners were planning to assault me. This was patently false. They had brought me back to Pretoria for their own motives, which soon became clear. I was kept in solitary confinement at Pretoria Local, but prisoners are resourceful, and I was soon receiving secret notes and other communications from some of the ANC people there. I had a communication from Henry Fazi, one of the MK cadres, who had undergone military training in Ethiopia and been arrested while attempting to return to South Africa. They were among the first ANC members to be tried under the Sabotage Act. Through the prison grapevine, I attempted to help them with their defense and suggested they contact Harold Wolp. I later heard that Wolp was in police detention. This was my first intimation that something had gone seriously wrong. One day, as I was being led away from the courtyard after exercise, I saw Andrew Mlangeni. I had last seen him in September of 1961, when he was leaving the country for military training. Wolp? Mlangeni? Who else was under arrest? Early in 1961, Winnie had been banned for 2 years. I heard from another prisoner that Winnie had recently been charged with violating her bans, which could lead to imprisonment or house arrest. Winnie was headstrong. A banning order was just the type of thing that would make her angry. I had no doubt that she violated her orders, and I would never counsel her not to do so, but it concerned me greatly that she might spend time in prison. One morning in July 1963, as I was walking along the passage to my cell, I saw Thomas Moshifoni, who had been the foreman at Lily's Leaf Farm. I greeted him warmly, though I realized that the authorities had undoubtedly led him to my passage to see if I recognized or acknowledged him. I could not help but do otherwise. His presence there could mean only one thing. The authorities had discovered Rivonia. A day or two later,
I was summoned to the prison office, where I found Walter, Govan Mbeki, Ahmed Kathrada, Andrew Mlangeni, Bob Heppel, Raymond Mklaba, a member of the MK High Command, who had recently returned from training in China, Elias Motsoaledi, also a member of MK, Dennis Goldberg, an engineer and a member of the Congress of Democrats, Rusty Bernstein, an architect and also a member of the COD, and Jimmy Cantor, an attorney who was Harold Wolpe's brother-in-law. We were all charged with sabotage and scheduled to appear in court the next day. I had served just 9 months of my 5-year sentence. In bits and pieces, I learned what had happened. On the afternoon of July 11th, a dry cleaner's van entered the long driveway of the farm. No one at Lily's Leaf had ordered a delivery. The vehicle was stopped by a young African guard, but he was overwhelmed when dozens of armed policemen and several police dogs sprang from the vehicle. They surrounded the property, and a handful of officers entered the main building and the principal outbuilding. In the latter, they found a dozen men around a table discussing a document. Walter jumped out a window, but was cut off by a snarling police dog. The arrests also included Arthur Goldreich, who had driven into the farm as the police raid was in progress. The police searched the entire farm and confiscated hundreds of documents and papers, though they found no weapons. One of the most important documents remained right on the table, Operation Mayebuye, a plan for guerrilla warfare in South Africa. In one fell swoop, the police had captured the entire high command of Umkhonto Wesizwe. Everyone was detained under the new 90-day detention law. Joe Slovo and Bram Fischer were fortunately not there at the time of the raid, but Joe and Bram often went to the farm 2 or 3 times a day. In hindsight, it is extraordinary that Lily's Leaf was not discovered sooner. The regime had become stricter and more sophisticated. Wiretaps had become common, as was 24-hour surveillance. The raid was a coup for the state. On our first day in court, we were not given the opportunity to instruct counsel. We were brought before a magistrate and charged with sabotage. A few days later, we were allowed to meet with Bram, Vernon Beranger, Joel Joff, George Bezos, and Arthur Chaskelson, all of whom were acting for us. I was still being kept separately as I was a convicted prisoner, and these sessions were my first opportunity to talk with my colleagues. Bram was very somber. In his quiet voice, he told us that we were facing an extremely serious trial, and that the state had formally advised him they would ask for the supreme penalty permitted by law, the death sentence. Given the climate of the times, Bram said, this result was a very real possibility. From that moment on, we lived in the shadow of the gallows. The mere possibility of a death sentence changes everything. From the start, we considered it the most likely outcome of the trial. Far lesser crimes than ours had recently been punished by life sentences. Prison officials never let you forget that you might hang. That night, a warder rapped on my cell door at bedtime. Mandela, you don't have to worry about sleep, he said. You are going to sleep for a long, long time. I waited a moment and said, all of us, you included, are going to sleep for a long, long time. It was small consolation. Chapter 55. On October 9th, 1963, we were picked up in a heavily fortified police van. It had a steel divider running along the center, segregating the white prisoners from the Africans. We were driven to the Palace of Justice in Pretoria, where the Supreme Court sits, for the opening of The State versus the National High Command and Others, what later became known as The State versus Nelson Mandela and Others, and is still better known as the Rivonia Trial. Near the court stands a statue of Paul Kruger, the President of the Republic of the Transvaal, who fought against British imperialism in the 19th century. Underneath this Afrikaner hero is a quotation from one of his speeches. The inscription reads, In confidence we lay our cause before the whole world. Whether we win or whether we die, freedom will rise in Africa like the sun from the morning clouds. Our van was in the center of a convoy of police trucks. At the front of this motorcade were limousines carrying high police officials. The Palace of Justice was teeming with armed policemen. To avoid the enormous crowd of our supporters who had grouped in front of the building, we were driven into the rear of the building and taken in through great iron gates. All around the building, police officers with machine guns stood at attention. As we descended from the van, we could hear the great crowd singing and chanting. Once inside, we were held in cells below the courtroom before the opening of what was depicted in the newspapers at home and around the world as the most significant political trial in the history of South Africa. As we emerged from the cells, each of the accused was accompanied by two armed wardens. When we entered the ornate, high-ceilinged courtroom, we each turned to the crowd and made a clenched fist ANC salute. In the visitors' gallery, our supporters shouted, "Amandla, Ngawetu," and "Mayebuye, Africa." This was inspiring but dangerous. The police took the names and addresses of all the spectators in the galleries and photographed them as they left the court. The courtroom was filled with domestic and international journalists and dozens of representatives of foreign governments. After we filed in, a group of police officers formed a tight cordon between us and the spectators. I was disgusted to have to appear in court wearing my prison clothes of khaki shorts and flimsy sandals. As a convicted prisoner, I did not have the choice of wearing proper clothes. Many people later commented on how poorly I looked, and not just because of my wardrobe. I had been in and out of solitary confinement for months, and I had lost more than 25 pounds. I took pains to smile at the gallery when I walked into the courtroom, and seeing our supporters was the best medicine I could have had. Security was particularly tight, as only a few weeks before, Arthur Goldreich, Harold Wolp, Mosi Mula, and Abdulé Jasset had bribed a young guard and escaped from jail. Arthur and Harold made their way to Swaziland disguised as priests, then flew to Tanganyika. Their escape came at a time of hysteria about the underground and was greeted with blaring newspaper headlines. It was an embarrassment to the government and a boost to our morale. Our judge in the Rivonia trial was Mr. Quartus de Wet, judge president of the Transvaal, who sat in his flowing red robes beneath a wooden canopy. De Wet was one of the last judges appointed by the United Party before the Nationalists came to power, and was not considered a government lackey. He was a poker-faced judge who did not suffer fools gladly. The prosecutor was Dr. Percy Utah, deputy attorney general of the Transvaal, whose ambition was to become Attorney General of South Africa. He was a small, bald, dapper fellow whose voice squeaked when he became angry or emotional. He had a flair for the dramatic and for high-flown, if imprecise, language. Utah rose and addressed the court. "My lord, I call the case of the state against the National High Command and others." I was accused number one. Utah handed in the indictment and authorized that we be charged immediately and tried summarily. This was the first time we were given a copy of the indictment. The prosecution had kept it from us, though they gave it to the Rand Daily Mail, which had splashed it all over that day's edition of the paper. The indictment charged 11 of us with complicity in over 200 acts of sabotage aimed at facilitating violent revolution and an armed invasion of the country. The state contended that we were actors in a conspiracy to overthrow the government. We were charged with sabotage and conspiracy, rather than high treason, because the law does not require a long preparatory examination, which is highly useful to the defense for sabotage and conspiracy, as it does for treason. Yet the supreme penalty, death by hanging, is the same. With high treason, the state must prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt and needs two witnesses to testify to each charge. Under the sabotage law, The onus was on the defense to prove the accused innocent. Bram Fischer stood up and asked the court for a remand on the grounds that the defense had not had time to prepare its case. He noted that a number of the accused had been held in solitary confinement for unconscionable lengths of time. The state had been preparing for 3 months, but we had only received the indictment that day. Justice DeWitt gave us a 3-week adjournment until October 29th. I was disturbed to discover that first day that Winnie was unable to attend. Because of her banning and her restriction to Johannesburg, she needed police permission to come to court. She had applied and been refused. I also learned that our house had been raided and the police had detained a young relative of Winnie's. Winnie was not the only wife being harassed. Albertina Sisulu and Carolyn Matsoalede were detained under the 90-Day Detention Act, and Walter's young son, Max, was also arrested. This was one of the state's most barbarous techniques of applying pressure, imprisoning the wives and children of freedom fighters. Many men in prison were able to handle anything the authorities did to them, but the thought of the state doing the same thing to their families was almost impossible to bear. Winnie subsequently appealed to the Minister of Justice, who granted her permission to attend the trial on the condition that she did not wear traditional dress. Ironically, the same government that was telling us to embrace our culture in the homelands forbade Winnie from wearing a Xhosa gown into court. During the next 3 weeks, we were permitted to spend our days together preparing our case. I was now among my fellow accused, and the company of my colleagues was a tonic. As awaiting trial prisoners, we were entitled to 2 half-hour visits a week, and 1 meal a day could be sent in from the outside. I soon gained back my lost weight with Mrs. Pile's delicious dinners. While we were preparing our defense, the government was trying the case in the newspapers. Normally, a case that is sub judice cannot be commented upon in public or in the press. But since the men arrested at Rivonia were 90-day detainees and therefore not technically charged with a crime, this judicial principle went by the wayside. We were publicly branded as violent revolutionaries by everyone from the Minister of Justice on down. Newspapers regularly featured headlines like "Revolution on Military Basis." On October 29th, we again entered the Palace of Justice. Again, the crowds were large and excited. Again, the security was extremely tight. Again, the court was filled with dignitaries from many foreign embassies. After 3 weeks with my comrades, I felt rejuvenated, and I was far more comfortable in court, this time in a suit. Our attorneys had objected to our having to come to court in prison garb, and we had won the right to wear our own clothes. We again raised clenched fists to the gallery and were warned that if we did it again, we would be forced to come to court in our prison khakis. To prevent such outbursts, the authorities reversed the normal order of the prisoners preceding the judge into the courtroom. After that first day, the judge entered first so that court would already be in session when we entered. We went on the attack immediately. Bram Fischer criticized the state's indictment as shoddy, poorly drawn, and containing absurdities such as the allegation that I had participated in certain acts of sabotage on dates when I was in Pretoria local. Utah was flummoxed. Judge DeWitt looked to him to reply to Bram's argument, and instead of offering particulars, he began to give what the judge derided as a political speech. DeWitt was impatient with Utah's fumbling and told him so. "The whole basis of your argument, as I understand it, Mr. Utah, is that you are satisfied that the accused are guilty." DeWitt then quashed the indictment and gaveled the session to a close. For that moment, we were technically free, and there was pandemonium in the court. But we were rearrested even before Judge DeWitt left his seat. Lieutenant Swanepoel clapped each of us on the shoulder and said, "I am arresting you on a charge of sabotage," and we were herded back to our cells. Even so, this was a blow to the government. for they now had to go back to the drawing board in the case they were calling the trial to end all trials. The state withdrew their indictment, and we were back in court in early December. We all sensed that in the interim, Justice DeWitt had grown more hostile to us. We suspected his previous independence had brought down the wrath of the government, and pressure had been applied. The new charges were read. We were alleged to have recruited persons for sabotage and guerrilla warfare for the purpose of starting a violent revolution. We had allegedly conspired to aid foreign military units to invade the Republic in order to support a communist revolution, and we had solicited and received funds from foreign countries for this purpose. The orders for munitions on the part of the accused, said Utah melodramatically, were enough to blow up Johannesburg. The registrar then requested our pleas. We had not agreed to plea in the traditional manner, but to use the moment to show our disdain for the proceedings. Accused number one, Nelson Mandela, do you plead guilty or not guilty? I rose and said, My lord, it is not I, but the government that should be in the dock. I plead not guilty. Accused number two, Walter Sisulu, do you plead guilty or not guilty? Sisulu, the government is responsible for what has happened in this country. I plead not guilty. Justice DeWitt said he was not interested in hearing political speeches, that we should merely plead not guilty or guilty. But his direction was ignored. Each of the accused suggested that it was the government that was the criminal before pleading not guilty. To enhance the drama of the proceedings, the state had made arrangements for a live broadcast of Utah's speech on the South African broadcasting system. Microphones had been placed on the prosecution table as well as in front of the judge. But just as Utah was clearing his throat, Bram Fischer rose and made an application to the court for the removal of the microphones on the grounds that the broadcasts would unfairly prejudice the case and were not in keeping with the dignity of the court. Despite Utah's shrill plea for their retention, Justice DeWitt ordered them removed. In his address, Utah argued that from the time the ANC had been driven underground, the organization had embarked on a policy of violence designed to lead from sabotage through guerrilla warfare to an armed invasion of the country. He asserted that we planned to deploy thousands of trained guerrilla units throughout the country, and these units were to spearhead an uprising that would be followed by an armed invasion by military units of a foreign power. In the midst of the resulting chaos, turmoil, and disorder, Utah proclaimed, it was planned by the accused to set up a provisional revolutionary government to take over the administration and control of the country. The engine of this grand plan was Nkonto Wisizwe. Under the political direction of the ANC and the Communist Party, and the headquarters of Nkonto was Rivonia. In his orotund prose, Utah described how we recruited members for MK, how we planned our national uprising for 1963. Here he was confusing us with the PAC. How we erected a powerful radio transmitter at Rivonia, and how we were collectively responsible for 222 acts of sabotage. He said Elias Matsoaledi and Andrew Umlangeni were in charge of recruiting members, and that Dennis Goldberg ran a special school for recruits in the Cape. He detailed the production of various bombs, as well as the solicitation of money abroad. Over the next 3 months, the state produced 173 witnesses and entered into the records thousands of documents and photographs, including standard works on Marxism, histories of guerrilla warfare, maps, blueprints, and a passport made out to one David Motsamai. The first witness was a police photographer who had taken pictures of Rivonia, and the next witnesses were domestic workers for the Goldreich family, who had been held in detention all this time, even though they had no connection to the politics of the household. These servants identified most of us by pointing to us in the dock. But old Mr. Jellyman, in a brave attempt to help me, pretended that he did not see me when he was asked to point to accused number one. Look again, the prosecutor said. Go over all the faces carefully. I do not think he is here, Jellyman said quietly. We wondered what evidence the state had to prove my guilt. I had been out of the country and in prison while much of the planning at Rivonia had taken place. When I saw Walter in Pretoria Local just after my sentencing, I urged him to make sure that all my books and notes were removed from the farm. But during the first week of the trial, when Rusty Bernstein applied for bail, Percy Utah dramatically produced the sketch of the fort and the accompanying note about escape that I had made while detained there. Utah exclaimed that this was evidence that all of the accused meant to escape. It was a sign that nothing of mine had been removed from Rivonia. Later, I was told that my colleagues at Rivonia had decided to preserve my escape note because they thought it would be historic in the future. But in the present, it cost Rusty Bernstein his bail. The state's star witness was Bruno Mtolo, or Mr. X, as he was known in court. In introducing Mr. X, Utah informed the court that the interrogation would take 3 days, and then, in theatrical tones, he added that the witness was in mortal danger. Utah asked that the evidence be given in camera, but that the press be included, provided that they not identify the witness. Mtolo was a tall, well-built man with an excellent memory. A Zulu from Durban, he had become the leader of the Natal region of MK. He was an experienced saboteur and had been to Rivonia. I had met him only once when I addressed his group of MK cadres in Natal after my return from the continent. His evidence concerning me in particular made me realize that the state would certainly be able to convict me. He began by saying that he was an MK saboteur who had blown up a municipal office, a power pylon, and an electricity line with impressive precision. He explained the operation of bombs, landmines, and grenades, and how MK worked from underground. Mtolo said that while he had never lost faith in the ideals of the ANC, he did lose faith in the organization when he realized that it and MK were instruments of the Communist Party. His testimony was given with simplicity and what seemed like candor, but Mtolo had gone out of his way to embellish his evidence. This was undoubtedly done on police instructions. He told the court that during my remarks to the Natal Regional Command, I had stated that all MK cadres ought to be good communists, but not to disclose their views publicly. In fact, I never said anything of the sort. But his testimony was meant to link me and MK to the Communist Party. His memory appeared so precise, the ordinary person would assume that it was accurate in all instances. But this was not so. I was bewildered by Mtolo's betrayal. I never ruled out the possibility of even senior ANC men breaking down under police torture, but by all accounts, Mtolo was never touched. On the stand, he went out of his way to implicate people who were not even mentioned in the case. It is possible, I know, to have a change of heart, but to betray so many others, many of whom were quite innocent, seemed to me inexcusable. During cross-examination, we learned that Mtolo had been a petty criminal before joining MK and had been imprisoned 3 previous times for theft. But despite these revelations, he was an extremely damaging witness, for the judge found him reliable and believable, and his testimony incriminated nearly all of us. The keystone of the state's case was the 6-page plan of action confiscated in the Rivonia raid. The leaders of the High Command had had this very document before them on the table when the police stormed the farm. Operation Mayebuye sketches out, in general form, the plan for the possible commencement of guerrilla operations and how it might spark a mass armed uprising against the government. It envisions an initial landing of small guerrilla forces in 4 different areas of South Africa and the attacking of pre-selected targets. The document set a goal of 7,000 MK recruits in the country, who would meet the initial outside force of 120 trained guerrillas. The prosecution's case rested, in large part, on their contention that Operation Mayebuye had been approved by the ANC executive and had become the operating plan of MK. We insisted that Operation Mayebuye had not yet been formally adopted and was still under discussion at the time of the arrests. As far as I was concerned, Operation Mayebuye was a draft document that was not only not approved, but was entirely unrealistic in its goals and plans. I did not believe that guerrilla warfare was a viable option at that stage. The plan had been drafted in my absence, so I had very little knowledge of it. Even among the Rivonia trialists, there was disagreement as to whether the plan had been adopted as ANC policy. Govan, who had drafted the document with Joe Slovo, insisted that it had been agreed upon and felt that it was wrong for us to argue in court that it was still under discussion. But all the other accused contended that the document, while drawn up by the High Command, had not been approved by the ANC executive or even seen by Chief Latuli. Although a capital trial can be quite grim, our spirits were generally high. There was a good deal of gallows humor among us. Dennis Goldberg, the youngest of the accused, had an irrepressible sense of humor and often had us laughing when we should not have been. When one of the prosecution witnesses described how Raymond Mhlaba had worn a clerical collar as a disguise, Dennis took to calling him Reverend Mhlaba. In our consulting room downstairs, we often communicated through notes, which we would then burn and throw in the wastebasket. One of the special branch officers who looked after us was Lieutenant Swanepoel, a burly, red-faced fellow who was convinced we were always putting one over on him. One day, while Swanepoel was observing us from the door, Govan Mbeki began to write a note in a conspicuously secretive manner. With similar drama, he handed me the note. I read it, nodded my head sagely, and passed it to Kathy, who ostentatiously took out his matches as if to burn the note, when Swanepoel swooped into the room, grabbed the paper out of Kathy's hands, and said something about the dangers of lighting matches indoors. He then left the room to read his prize. A few seconds later, he stormed back, saying, "I will get all of you for this." Govan had written in capital letters, "Isn't Swanepoel a fine-looking chap?" We were locked up in prison and on trial for our lives, but outside new life was blossoming. Jimmy Cantor's wife was to give birth any day. Jimmy was an attorney who had been roped into the trial by the state for no other reason than that he was Harold Wolpe's brother-in-law. One moment, when we were sitting in the dock, a note was passed down to me from the other end. Barbara and I have discussed godfathers at length, and we have come to the conclusion that, whether the baby is a girl or boy, we would consider it an honor if you would agree to accept this office as an adjunct to the more disreputable positions you have held in the past. By return mail, I sent Jimmy Beck a note. "I would be more than delighted, and the honor is mine, not the baby's. Now they dare not hang me." Chapter 56. The state case continued through the Christmas season of 1963, ending on February 29, 1964. We had a little over a month to examine the evidence and prepare our defense. We were not all equally affected by the evidence. There was no evidence against James Cantor. He was not even a member of our organization and should not have been on trial at all. For Rusty Bernstein, Raymond Mhlaba, and Ahmed Kathrada, the evidence of involvement and conspiracy was slight, and we decided they should not incriminate themselves. In Rusty's case, the evidence was negligible. He had merely been found at Rivonia with the others. The remaining six of us would make admissions of guilt on certain charges. Bram was deeply pessimistic. He avowed that even if we proved that guerrilla war had not been approved and our policy of sabotage was designed not to sacrifice human life, the state could still impose the death sentence. The defense team was divided on whether or not we should testify. Some asserted that it would hurt our case if we testified. George Bezos, though, suggested that unless we gave evidence and convinced the judge that we had not decided on guerrilla warfare, he would certainly impose the supreme penalty. Right from the start, we had made it clear that we intended to use the trial not as a test of the law, but as a platform for our beliefs. We would not deny, for example, that we had been responsible for acts of sabotage. We would not deny that a group of us had turned away from nonviolence. We were not concerned with getting off or lessening our punishment, but with having the trial strengthen the cause for which we were all struggling, at whatever cost to ourselves. We would not defend ourselves in a legal sense so much as in a moral sense. We saw the trial as a continuation of the struggle by other means. We would readily admit what was known by the state to be true, but refused to give away any information we thought might implicate others. We would dispute the state's central contention that we had embarked on guerrilla warfare. We would admit that we had made contingency plans to undertake guerrilla warfare in the event sabotage failed, but we would claim it had not yet failed, for it had not been sufficiently attempted. We would deny the claims of murder and damage to innocent bystanders that the state alleged. Either these claims were outright lies, or the incidents were the work of someone else. We had never contemplated the intervention of foreign military forces. In order to make these claims, we believed we would have to explain Operation Mayebuye to the court. In my own case, the court had sufficient evidence for a conviction. Documents in my handwriting showed that I had left the country illegally, had arranged for military training for our men, and had been behind the formation of Umkhonto we Sizwe. There was also a document in my handwriting called How to Be a Good Communist, which the state suggested was proof that I was a card-carrying communist. In fact, the document's title was taken from the work of a Chinese theoretician named Liu Shaoqi, and was written by me to prove a point to Moses Kotani. We had been engaged in a running debate about the appeal of communism to ordinary South Africans. I had long argued that communist literature was, for the most part, dull, esoteric, and Western-centered, but ought to be simple, clear, and relevant to the African masses. Moses insisted it could not be done. To prove my point, I had taken Liu's essay and rewritten it for an African audience. I would be the first witness, and therefore set the tone for the defense. In South African courts, evidence from the witness box can be given only in the form of an answer to a question. I did not want to be limited to that format. We decided that instead of giving testimony, I would read a statement from the doc, while the others would testify and go through cross-examination. Because a witness making a statement from the doc does not submit to cross-examination or questions from the bench, the statement does not have the same legal weight as ordinary testimony. Those who choose to make such a statement usually do so to avoid cross-examination. Our attorneys warned me that it would put me in a more precarious legal situation. Anything I said in my statement regarding my own innocence would be discounted by the judge. But that was not our highest priority. We believed it was important to open the defense with a statement of our politics and ideals, which would establish the context for all that followed. I wanted very much to cross swords with Percy Utah, but it was more important that I use the platform to highlight our grievances. All of this was agreed upon in consultation, mainly through notes because the consultation room was bugged. We even used the state's eavesdropping to our advantage by supplying them with disinformation. We gave every indication that I was going to testify so that they would spend their time planning their cross-examination. In a staged conversation, I told our attorney, Joel Joffe, that I would need the treason trial record to prepare my testimony. We smiled at the notion of Utah poring over the 100 or so volumes of treason trial transcripts. I spent about a fortnight drafting my address, working mainly in my cell in the evenings. When I was finished, I read it first to my comrades and fellow accused. They approved of it, suggesting a few changes, and then I asked Bram Fischer to look it over. Bram became concerned after reading it, and had a respected advocate named Hal Hansen read it. Hansen told Bram, "If Mandela reads this in court, they